Very nice afternoon. Day went by kind of quickly, didn't it? So we've learned two. I'll take some questions or comments in just a moment, but I'll just kind of point to the two things we've kind of learned today. If we're going to cultivate right intention, then good or bad, however the moment is, we need to be in the present moment. We need to be connected to the present moment in some way. And the second thing that we were working on this afternoon is there needs to be a learning or a recognition that some thoughts, some of our thinking is harmful. It's not the doing. We sometimes think that what's harmful is if I actually hit someone, but nobody's going to hit anybody in here. But you don't know, teachers, we're kind of secret. We can hear your thinking. We didn't know there was some hitting going on. So there's a way in which we think, if we think it, it's okay. There's no problem here. But that thinking process is as harmful as the physical hitting of someone. It's just that no harm is done to anyone but you until you come face to face with that person. And then, even though you don't actually strike them, the way you are with them is like a striking. This is a quote by Thich Nhat Hanh. Let's see if I can get it. Yeah, here he is. He said that a monk decides to meditate alone, away from his monastery. He takes a boat and goes to the middle of the lake, closes his eyes, and begins to meditate. After a few hours of unperturbed silence, he suddenly feels the blow of another boat hitting him. With his eyes closed, he feels his anger rising, and when he opens his eyes, he is ready to shout at the boatman who dared to disturb his meditation. But when he opened his eyes, he saw that it was an empty boat, not tied up, floating in the middle of the lake. At that moment, the monk realized, achieved this self-realization, and understood that anger was within him. It simply needs to hit an external object to provoke it. After that, whenever he meets someone who irritates or provokes his anger, he remembers the other person is just an empty boat. Anger is inside me. So there's a thing here that you're learning to see. If we're going to cultivate right intention, we have to begin to see that our thoughts are far more important than we give them credit for. They are the builders of the castles that we live in. And even though those castles might only be in our own minds, we live out of those castles. And that is the nature of what we think the world is that we live in. So if we're going to cultivate right intention, we have to begin to recognize the thoughts that are harmful, unwholesome, they are not skillful, and the thoughts that are skillful, wholesome, supportive. There's no shame here, because there's not a single person in this room, including the Buddha statue, who does not have thoughts of ill will. This is not something that is related to you or where you grew up or how bad your circumstances were or what you come from. It doesn't really matter. We all have the exact same anger. We all have the exact same rage. We all think that our rage is more important than someone else's rage. But rage is rage is rage. It doesn't really matter whether it is a big, wholesome, justified rage or some random, irritating rage. It's still rage. I remember Bonnie Duran. Do you guys know Bonnie Duran? She's this indigenous woman in the States. She lives in Seattle, where I live. Bonnie Duran taught this three-month I was sitting one time. And she was giving her Dhamma talk, and she said, I just hear all this irritation. There's so much irritation in the room, and people are complaining about this and upset about that, and I couldn't understand why there was so much upset in the room. I mean, I think everything is going great. And she goes, oh, I realize these are first world problems. First world problems. That's what we live with. The minute she said it, I understood. We live with problems that are related to first world. So it might be temperature in the room. It might be how much space I have. It might be things like that that seem, from the perspective of someone who lives in a third world, that is stupid. I have a friend that goes to Thailand to sit, and if you ask for a cushion, they hand you a wooden block. You ask for a cushion, they'll give you some kind of, this is an American, give them a cushion. They give you like a cement block, a wooden block, and that's your cushion. It's a different world. We all live in different cultures, different worlds. Some people have to worry about war, and we do not. But when it comes to the rage and the anger and the irritation and the frustration and the sadness and the disappointment, in the moment you feel it, it's as real as if you were in war. And learning to recognize that and not shy away from it or poo-poo it or treat it like it's not that big of a deal. Learning to recognize it and see it for what it is what helps us begin to set these intentions right. And it ultimately has the capacity to cut through all of our negative thinking and still our hearts. That's what happens. That's why I didn't care how loud you got at lunchtime, because I knew once we came back, sit a little, walk a little, sit a little, walk a little, the stillness would come right back, because it's never gone anywhere. It's always here. But we get so caught in this undisciplined mind that we forget how close that stillness is. I want to give a few minutes for us to see if there's any questions or if anybody had any comments, and then we'll talk and prepare for tomorrow, this final piece. Yeah. It's all the way in the back. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So my question is just about this idea of unwholesome and wholesome thoughts. For me, as soon as I start categorizing, it's very hard not to fall into judgment, like good and bad thoughts. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if you have any suggestions around how to not get caught in that.
That's a really good question. When I first heard this word unwholesome, I don't like that word, unwholesome. This is what Buddha called them, unwholesome, or that's the way it's translated in English as unwholesome. What I really like is his translation he gave to his son Rahula that we're going to talk about tomorrow. He calls it skillful, and unskillful. So it's the same thing. But the reason why I stuck with unwholesome and didn't call it skillful is because there's a two-step process to know something is skillful or unskillful. First, it's the recognition, and then it's the noticing what happens with that thought. It's not just that the thought is good, bad, unwholesome, wholesome, whatever. It's that when these thoughts of ill will, harm, or, you know, indulgence, or what I call the habit thoughts, when they show up, we have to notice not just that this is a habit thought, but what does it do to me if I continue to think on it? So planning, for those of you that are planners, it doesn't seem like that's a bad thing. I mean, I'm planning. I'm getting my world organized. There's no problem with that. But then if you begin to notice that planning as a habit, as opposed to a necessary thing, the whole house is getting all caught up in your planning, and everything has to be planned out. And if it's not planned out, then we can't do that, and it becomes this control mechanism. And there's no difference in that controlling nature, the responsiveness of that, as it is to my aversion. So I have a critical mind. I criticize everything. I don't like this. I don't like that. I like this. I don't like. Don't like. 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 That's where my mind is. But that mind, when it gets caught in its habitual nature, then the whole world has to adjust to my likes and my don't likes, my whims and what I want and what I don't want. And so there's a way in which I called it wholesome, unwholesome, so we can first see that there is a kind of categorizing it, and then there is a noticing what the response is. Tomorrow, we can begin to consider this as skillful, unskillful, because we're going to see the Buddha has a way of talking to Rahula that really kind of articulates what it is that we're going to try to ultimately do. So that was a perfect question. That's what I was thinking. I was just going to tell you tomorrow. Right thinking, right on time. Yeah, go ahead. What's her name?
Sheena.
Sheena, go ahead. Nice name.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Just wondering if, oh gosh, when I was observing my thoughts and trying to identify between wholesome and unwholesome, it's often difficult to find a category.
Yeah.
At least at the outset of noticing. I'm just wondering if there are other categories.
I think if you say neutral, but we want to know what is that thinking? What is the thinking about? So sometimes neutral is kind of ignoring. It's not necessarily present. That's what you're really trying to see. If it's so, let me put it like this. There are actually 6 feeling tones. We usually only talk about 3 of them. But there's worldly, unpleasant Vedana, pleasant Vedana, and this worldly, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And we call that neutral. So there's a way that neutral is treated like that that neither pleasant nor unpleasant Vedana. But that neither pleasant nor unpleasant Vedana in the worldly sense is ignoring. It is insignificant. It's sort of like boring, unimportant. So the mind could be neutral in its thinking, but it's because there's nothing going on. It's not important. I'm just kind of going through the motions. But you're actually not present. There is, on the flip side, what's called, and not the worldly Vedana, but unworldly pleasant, unworldly unpleasant, and unworldly neither pleasant. pleasant nor unpleasant, this kind of neutral. And in the unworldly Vedana, it is the Vedana that leads towards awakening. So it is the suffering that we connect to that's actually helping us understand the nature of the First Noble Truth. It's a kind of a suffering that's onward leading. So it may be unpleasant, but you're actually learning something from it. It may be pleasant, but it's sort of like the pleasure of rapture that comes in the seven factors of awakening. And it may be neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but the unworldly neutral would be in the present moment, completely satisfied. No wanting in the mind. No not wanting in the mind. You are content. So if that contentment is what you're talking about, then that is right intention. I mean, that right intention can come out of, because it's pleasant, there's nothing to be done about it. But if this neutral that you're talking about is more on the nothing's going on, you know, it's just this, whatever, you're not, it's worldly neutral. It's not the same thing. Do you see the difference? Yes? She's shaking her head, yes? I can't really see. Okay, there. Okay, we got you.
Thank you. Yes, I think I do. It will be really wonderful to sit and explore that a little bit more.
That's right.
We seem to just be meandering.
Yes.
Kind of on vacation as opposed to meaningful in some way.
That discernment right there is what you're looking for, is to begin to see, oh, this feels like I'm lost, kind of just, I'm not really, it's not contentment, but it's kind of something else. That right there is your beginning to sense into the difference between being in the present moment and not being in the present moment. And there's no right, wrong in the whole thing. What we're going to find tomorrow is that the actual willingness to investigate the nature of it, that is what is important. That's what puts us on the freeway. We'll be in Canada in 2 hours. All right. So, anybody else? Yeah. Back there.
Hello.
Microphone. Thank you. I just want to thank you so much. I first had the chance to hear you teaching, and I think it was May 2020, first online time I had with you. So this is my first time in person, and I'm just so grateful for so many of the words that you've offered in your teachings these last few years. It just brings me a lot of support to my regular life as a mom to a young, rambunctious child.
I had one of those too.
So just your offering of giving that peek into your world as a grandmother as well has been very, very supportive to me. So thank you so much for that, and as a mother. And today, one of my big takeaways has been something that you spoke to last night around spirituality, which is not a word that I feel like I've heard for a little while from other teachers. Mm-hmm. And in the last period of movement, I went outside again and was just, I guess, connected and reminded of how, for me, my Sangha is also the natural world. And I felt like you spoke to that earlier today as well, so I just want to really thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
I really needed to hear that, so thank you.
You're welcome. I was sharing last night, for those of you that weren't there, I can't remember the question, but I think somebody was talking about, there was something about there's a therapeutic modality that stresses learning how to connect with your values and how we're cultivating right intention, which is a similar kind of connection with our internal values. And the Buddha's right intention was also considered right thought, which is the thoughts of non-harm, goodwill, and renunciation. So this is what, actually I'm glad you said that, because this is what right intention is. It's the intention to do no harm, to be kind, and to have some restraint or renunciation in your life. Those three focuses is what right intention is. And what I was speaking to last night is that the right intention is not just about your individual life, because it's more connected to the everlasting life of the human condition. So the right intention was just as prevalent when the Buddha was practicing 2,700 years ago. It's the same right intention that we practice. It'll be the same right intention long after we're gone, 3,000 years from now. I know it may seem like we've pretty much dumped on the environment such that there won't be anybody around, but the understanding that we could have, that I'll say it like this. The one thing I wish that Jack and Joseph and Sharon had brought with them to this practice of insight that they didn't was the everlasting nature of it. So we don't believe in this idea of reincarnation or rebirth. And so in our kind of practice, we frame everything in this one lifetime. So everything has to happen in this one lifetime, or it doesn't work. But in truth, what the Buddha was talking about was not that you or I have to fix all things in this lifetime. It is the understanding that we set the intention in motion, and that energy continues forever. A lot of times, if we think about just our own ancestors, we are still carrying the energy of our grandparents and our great-grandparents, and it never ends. And then our children carry it on. We are also carrying the trauma of our grandparents and the great-grandparents, and that continues on unless we stop it. So there's a way in which that everlasting nature of Dhamma didn't get translated into this current iteration of insight practice. So it becomes sometimes held like a self-help practice that's going to help me get my life better. And what I was speaking to was that there is a much larger container that we are swimming in. Bigger waters, you could say. So when we set this right intention, it's not just an intention that's going to last until next year. That intention gets set in motion and it lasts way after we are long gone. It lasts in our relationships. It lasts in the ways we treat the land. It lasts in the ways we treat the animals. I was telling Marilyn and I, we were on the boat coming, and we saw these orcas. See what happened here? That's exactly what happened on that boat. Just this energy level went up, and people were all in an awe. Oh! And we saw a whole school of them, and they were baby there was a baby there with them, and so there was all this heightened energy and oohing and aahing, and it was just unbelievable. As humans, when we see animals in their natural habitat, we get all amiss with it. And yet, we are killing those, the land, the water they swim in. We are destroying it. So there's a way in which we're disconnected from the long-range effects of our conduct, our behavior, our ways of being. Right intention is not about how you're going to live out this life. Right intention is about the energy we put into the world that lasts forever. And it never ends. So just like we put right intention into the world, we also put this unwholesome, hurtful, harmful intention into the world. And it lasts forever. So what we're doing is setting the compass to begin to set in motion what may not show up in your lifetime. It may not show up in your kids' lifetime. But the idea is 7 generations later, it will show up. That's what we're doing here. So it's not so much about your life as much as it is about this much greater, wider world. You see? That's what we're doing. So that's what I was pointing to last night. Thank you. I had to say it because I might as well tell you, there is no recording from last night. And so if I didn't tell you, the people that were not here last night, that were not there last night, they would like me, well, what did she say? So now you know. Okay. Go ahead.
There is a very sweet message from the room here.
Oh, okay.
The participant says, thank you for your practice, Terry. This has been a very helpful day of practice. Thank you. Not then, and that's all she said, but I would like to echo that for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Me too. I've had really a wonderful time. It's probably because we're all back together again, that we all feel all intimate and close, and I'm glad. I've been very happy to be here. So we should close, see if there's any closing announcements, and then we will see each other tomorrow at 9 o'clock and do this last part.